The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. I'm Andy Cahan, and this is Friday Night. Geists, not Zeit and Poulter, but Bill and Willie, are father and son, and both popular television journalists and best-selling authors. Bill Geist has been a correspondent for CBS News Sunday Morning since 1987, for which he has received two Emmys for his everyman reportage of Americana. He has contributed to 60 Minutes 2, CBS Sports, and the New York Times. And his books inside include Little League Confidential and Way Off the Road. Willie Geist is co-host of NBC's Today program. I couldn't find their fanfare. And of MSNBC's Morning Joe. He is a contributor to NBC News and Sports and wrote American Freak Show. Told in back-and-forth style that riffs on popular culture and family life, Good Talk, Dad is a testament to the Geist's warm and endearing relationship. Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Joe Giuliano will interview the Geists this evening. I'll see you on the radio. Until then, please welcome Bill and Willie Geist and Joe Giuliano.
I was here for Dr. J, and that was about even to Dr. J's reception.
Stop it. That's blasphemy. That's blasphemy. I would have worn my dry cleaning pants instead of my washing machine pants if I'd known there were going to be this many people here.
Oh, gosh. Well, welcome to Philadelphia. Welcome to the Free Library.
Thank you.
Pleasure to be sharing the stage with both of you. A big fan of your dad. His writing is just something I've always admired, and welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. I noticed you played his theme music and not mine.
They weren't sure what show you were on.
Yeah. I see whose night this is. I get it. I'll be over here, the potted plant.
Well, we're here to talk about their new book, Good Talk, Dad. The description of it was accurate. Big Russ and Me meets Bleep, My Dad Says. As Willie says, 39 years of uninterrupted laughter, a relationship built on laughter and avoiding the other stuff. So what was the discussion like that produced this book? What made you want to write it?
Well, first of all, it is so great to be here. Thank you all for coming out on a Friday night. You never know. People have busy lives, and so we're so grateful that this room is full. We really appreciate you coming. We had a great day in Philadelphia today. My two kids are here with my wife. We took them to Franklin Square, and we saw Independence Hall, and we took them to the Liberty Bell. And then we went to the little mini golf course. You guys been over there? There's the new mini golf course. And there was a power outage today over there for some reason. So
right across from the street from Ben Franklin creating, inventing electricity.
As usual, he stole my punchline.
Oh.
I'm just going to leave.
Better find that Today Show theme pretty quick.
No, but to your question, people have asked us, I guess because we work in the business we do and we do the same thing, like, you guys should do something together someday, and we didn't quite know what that was. And 2 years ago, as many of you know, my dad went on Sunday morning and announced and told his vast audience. He reminds me it is a vast audience.
He always says 5 million, and I correct him to 6.
He told his audience that he has Parkinson's disease, and the truth of it is he's had it for 20 years. And for the first 10 of those years, he hadn't told me or my sister because it moved so slowly that we didn't even notice, to be honest with you. We thought he was slowing down a little bit, but certainly didn't think he had a disease. And so when he told the audience, we kind of joked that he'd told that audience more than he'd ever told his own children about his Parkinson's. And we thought, why don't we have those big conversations? You know, we have a great relationship. We love each other. I had a very happy childhood, but we weren't so good at the big talks. And so then we went back and realized we'd also never talked about sex. He never warned me about the dangers of drinking, didn't teach me how to drive a car.
I did 2 weeks ago. Yeah.
As I approach middle age, he's starting to have these talks with me. So we thought it would just be funny to go back, in many cases, you know, a quarter of a century too late and have these big talks that fathers and sons have together.
Yeah. So why didn't you like having these talks, Bill?
Well, the sex one, the birds and the bees, really was, I was just horrified. And I was afraid he'd contradict me because kids these days know more than we do. So I tried once during a baseball game. We watched a lot of baseball games together and attended many. But I said to Willie, I looked over, there was a pitching change, there was a little lag in the game, and I said, Willie, you think we ought to have that sex talk now? Yeah. And Willie just looked stunned. His face is frozen. And he said, do we have any pretzels?
And that was the last time that we ever talked about
time.
Sex.
But now I must say, since that happened, in writing this book, I wrote in the book some of the things that I would try to tell him. And the birds and the bees, and the birds, of course. Well, I don't know why it's birds and bees and not two dogs in the backyard and the bees, but birds attract each other with their feathers and singing and flying patterns and all that very intricate stuff. And bees are quite interesting. They can mate in midair. The drones mate with the queen, and then they drop dead. Any questions?
So you can see it's better that we didn't have the talk. Because my takeaway at age 14 would have been, okay, I have sex in midair and then I die. Got it.
So he never had it in midair.
So this left you in the kind of the lurch of trying to figure it out on your own.
I have 2 children backstage, so I figured something out. No, you know, it's funny, in going out and talking about this book, the more people we talk to, I don't know how all of you did with it, but anecdotally, a lot of people are not having the talk. They may sort of dance around the edges of it or kind of offer a few thoughts out there, but I don't think a lot of people are sitting down. It's plop down on the couch, son, let's talk about sex and go through it, you know, step by step. So I think it's just an uncomfortable conversation to have, and it's not easy. I'm not advocating for not having it. If you can, you should. But I think when people try to do it, it can oftentimes be very clumsy, as you can tell it was in our case. So a lot of people are identifying with our complete failure in a father-son conversation.
Well, in the book you mentioned, it's the Bill Geist Parenting Manual, and there were some great recollections that you had. Because my dad never talked to me about the birds and the bees, and he also taught me how to drive a stick while I was cursing in the driver's seat. I love the story about the Jeep CJ7. Could you just talk about learning how to drive on that thing?
Well, first of all, my mother, Jody, who's here in the front row tonight.
She's kind of monitors what we say.
Yes, she is. She's like a UN observer.
Yeah.
My mother, let's be honest, did the lion's share of the parenting.
That's correct.
Okay, good. I'm glad we agree on that.
That's why it's turned out so well.
Including teaching me how to drive, which is one of those things, can be a father-son thing, but my mom took me out. Our family car was a 1984 Jeep CJ7, and they got it brand new in 84, but with no frills whatsoever, no power steering. The back seat was an extra that they did spring for. We didn't have doors or a roof, It was an old army Jeep, essentially. And by the time I got around to driving age, it had been beaten up because, as I say, it was our car. We drove it on vacations and ran to the grocery store and everything else. You know, the floor was rusted through and everything, and it wouldn't go into first gear. So my mother taught me how to drive on a hilly road in our town in New Jersey called Heights Road, starting it in second gear, which, as you know, is difficult. You got to really jam on the gas and pop the clutch out. And so my mom and I would just lurch up and down the hill. I would be cursing, as you were, and I'd look over, and my mom was just laughing hysterically in my face. But her lesson to me was, if you can drive this awful car, you'll be able to drive any car for the rest of your life. And I've sort of, not to get too deep about this Jeep, but I've sort of used that as a governing philosophy in life. Like, start really hard, and then everything afterward will seem easy by comparison. So I give my mom credit for that lesson. I don't know if she intended it that way in that rusted out, terrible Jeep, but it worked. It worked.
My daughter, we have a daughter, Libby, Willie's sister, who inherited the car after we'd run it into the ground, and Willie just pretty much brought it to its knees. And she would call, she'd go to school. She'd drive the car toward school, but not to school. Because about 10 minutes after she'd leave in the morning, Jody would get a call that, to come and get her, have a tow truck come or something. So eventually it had to go.
And the other great story was the story of Camp, was it Camp Carson, was it?
That's the name we've used in the book to protect guilty parties.
You'll see by this story why we're not using the name of the camp. We don't have lawyers on the staff.
So, Bill, what was the
The idea was I was from the Midwest, and I'd never been to a great camp. I mean, I told somebody today that we had a fencing. They didn't say it, but the guy running the camp was a fencing instructor. So it was Thrust and Parry for weeks. And I wanted Willie to go to a great camp, a real camp, you know, where they made lanyards and took in the fresh air and the glistening lakes and the scent of the pine trees. And, well, what happened?
Well, they did this. I will just step back for 1 second. This is a classic example of my dad trying to do the right thing. Heart always in the right place, best of intentions, but it always goes wrong somewhere along the way. So in this case, he really wanted me to go to a good camp. We went to a big convention at the Javits Center in New York where you could sample the camps, and they all had...
Guy gave a slideshow in our
room. The guy came to our house in a slideshow, and this camp, Carson, we'll call it, my dad said, we love it, we're in. So my dad drops me off. The place looked the part. It had the lake. It was on Lake Winnipesaukee. It was beautiful. But what they didn't tell my dad, and what apparently was not in the brochure, was that the counselors at this camp were in a program for rehabilitating gang members. True story.
It was kind of an all-star camp. Yeah. They had some of the best gang members from around the country.
They came from urban centers around the Northeast to this camp.
Call them the Dream Team.
So these guys, I mean, they were gang members. They were in gangs. There were your Bloods and your Crips and the Latin Kings. I think the Disciple Lords were there, too. They were fun. And they had, as gangs will, they had fights. Like, there were territory. You know, you have kind of like the capture the flag games. No, they were having gang fights on the big field. And one night they slashed each other's tires in the parking lot. That led to a fight. At any given moment over the course of our run at the camp, a different member of a different gang was having a relationship with the nurse because there was basically one woman at the camp. And so you'd go, if you skinned your knee or, God forbid, worse, you'd go knock on the door of the nurse's station. It was always locked because she was in there with one of the gang members.
Doing paperwork, you know.
Yeah. But perhaps worst of all, and we can laugh now, there was an outbreak of impetigo, which is this highly contagious bacterial condition. So all the kids were getting it, and because they were gang members, they didn't know how to treat it. So the solution was to, we're 12 years old, they stripped us all down, put us up against a cinder block wall, and power washed us. So there we were, just fighting the hose. And I have a little nickel-sized scar on my arm from 1987 from the impetigo I got from
I got a $25 off coupon for that camp. And you did learn some things.
That's what when I finally told him, that's what he said. He goes, oh, that's why it was so cheap. Yeah.
Yeah, we didn't write about my cheapness in the book.
Oh, no, that's good. You talked about drinking, one of the things that he forgot or somehow avoided to tell Willie. And the name of the chapter is Talking to Teens About Drinking Once They've Reached Their 30s.
I think they have to have a perspective and knowledge before they have that first beer. We were the kind of parents, and I don't mean to sully Jody's reputation, but we allowed a couple of beers in the basement once in a while. And I think in being lax that way, it worked. We had credibility with the kids. Correct me if I'm wrong. Yep. But we had credibility when we talked about not drinking and driving, and we put our foot down on that at that point, that was never going to happen.
Yeah.
There were some great stories about Willie's drinking days.
We did do everything in the house. Somehow it worked that it kind of kept us there, including in New Jersey, it was pretty easy to make fake IDs off the driver's licenses. So we ran a little fake ID syndicate out of my mom's kitchen. I won't bore you with the details, but I could still make one if you need one. Basically, there's a laminate over the top, so you get some water boiling on the stove and the steam comes up and you hold the license over the steam and the glue loosens and you peel it back. Meanwhile, my mom's got fettuccine on the other stovetop, and we made fake IDs, which I thought was...
I didn't know that till I read this book.
Which I thought was resourceful. Another story my dad loves about our early days, my best friend lived on the third floor. He had his own floor in his house, so he was like the man, because we could go hang out on his third floor. The problem was his dad was a really tough guy, and he lived on the second floor. So you couldn't get anything past the dad. So in our high school, we were taking what they called Project Adventure, rappelling with the ropes and going down the sides of buildings and everything. So we worked up this elaborate network of pulleys. So we'd get on the roof of their house, and we'd get a 12-pack of the cheapest beer in the world, and we'd just work it up the side of the house. And then we got to the point where we were bringing people up and down, you know, kind of bouncing. His, like Navy SEALs, and my dad got a phone
his
call.
His friend's father called me, and he said, you won't believe it, there are ninjas going up the side of my house. And even he had to laugh a little bit about that.
Yes, yeah. He
was a strong...
Even he said, I got to respect that.
That's the ingenuity.
That's impressive.
And they say the public school system doesn't work. I mean, it paid off. How often do you do algebra?
I'm glad you told that story. That was a question of mine. How did you do that thing with the pulleys? Wow,
yeah.
That's incredible.
Use my education.
You haven't gone on to do any mountain climbing.
No. It ended there.
Yeah. Bill, in the book, you talk about how your parenting differs with the parenting of today. Mothers and fathers just trying to follow their child everywhere, being very protective, not letting them eat anything. Is there some kind of a happy medium between your style of parenting and that?
Undoubtedly, there must be. Let's hope to God there is. No, Jody was kind of the enforcer, and she had to come up with all the morality and whatever else was instilled in Willie.
Just morality.
I just had to. Well, he was tall. I always give him credit for that. That takes work.
I like somebody described your parenting style as free-range parenting.
Yes. It was free-range parenting. But in free-range chickens, you still watch the chickens and where they're going.
Yeah,
you round them up when you have to. But we had great kids. And I say my parenting style is lucky.
He was a good dad. There's no question about it. I think it was just, as many of you can probably attest, it was a different time. 40 years ago, my dad tells the story of now, you know, we double lock our kids in the car seats and everything else that you should do. But in the 1977 or whatever it was, we had a Volkswagen Bug was our family car. And he talks about me just standing on the front seat, bouncing up and down as we drove. And as every parent does, when you hit the brakes, you just put the arm out.
You're not familiar with that? My mother did that to me.
Of course.
I always thought she was trying to get rid of me.
You did miss once. I have a little scar right here where I popped the windshield.
Probably knocked some sense into you.
But my we have some tactics that I think you probably didn't use.
He has a great parenting tactic or strategy.
My 4-year-old son, who's here somewhere tonight, and is a very, very good boy, I want to say.
He's here somewhere.
His name is George. And so he loves the New York cops and firefighters. Like, that's it. Those are the guys. And so there's a restaurant right next to the 20th Precinct in our neighborhood, and we stop all the time, and they're great to George, and they show him in the back, and they show him all the equipment, and they give him an NYPD patch that he can put on his jacket. But there is the odd, rare occasion where we have to ask the NYPD to step in as third-party disciplinarians.
No blackjacks are involved.
I want to be clear, this is rare. Usually we go in under good circumstances, but the way it goes is George has like had a tough week or a tough 2 weeks. He's hitting his sister, talking back to his mom, whatever it is. And so we stop in the police station. He thinks he's getting the badge and the patch and everything else. And then he can tell sort of by the tenor that this is different. And the cop comes out, and we give the cop the look. George starts a little backpedal. The cops, he's got the uniform and the badge and the gun, and we say, "Officer, we know you've got bigger fish to fry, but George has been hitting his sister." And God bless him, the guys at the 20th Precinct go, whoa, "George, don't hit your sister." "Listen to me, George. Don't hit your sister, George. You understand me? Mom is eating the vegetables? Good. All right, eat the vegetables. Good. All right, George, go ahead. Go home. Get out of here. Let's go."
Al Pacino do that.
It buys us like a month of good behavior. It's fantastic.
Relatively good behavior.
He may need a little therapy somewhere down the road, but just a little.
One thing that resonated with me was, because of my dad's interest in sports and mine, is you guys were always talking sports, conversations usually started that way.
That's about all we talked about. since then, grandchildren have become another topic.
That's
so
right,
we have
yeah.
two topics.
What are your best memories of, you know, just being together for games and things like that, Yankee games, Mets games?
Yeah, well, the professional.
Sorry, guys.
We started out with the Cubs in Chicago, and I think he got a bad taste in his mouth. I'd try and convince him that winning or losing wasn't really important. But then he came to New York and noticed that the Yankees were having parades every year down the Canyon of Heroes and all the confetti and stuff. And so I kind of had to lay low for a while. I couldn't convince him of that.
I hesitate to talk in Philly about our sports allegiances. This could get
ugly.
Don't
do it. Don't do it.
We don't want to turn you against us yet. Wait, have you bought the books yet? No. We moved when I was 5 to New York, and I kind of adopted the Yankees. I do want to point out, nobody wants to hear a whiny Yankee fan, but
no.
From 1981, this is my childhood, 1981 when they went to the World Series and lost to the Dodgers, not only did they not make the World Series, they didn't make the playoffs until 1995. Just want to say, people forget that about the Yankees. Thank you. I just need a second here. Thank you. So anyway, I was a huge Yankee fan, and my favorite player, Don Mattingly, was my favorite, but Dave Winfield was like, he was my heart. I love Dave Winfield. And when we'd go on vacation when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years old probably, we'd go up to Cape Cod for a week, and I would write Dave Winfield postcards for my vacation because I thought he sensed I wasn't at home watching the games on TV.
And
I didn't want to let him down.
Those postcards began, Dear
Winfield.
Dear Winfield.
Yeah. And so I would take a postcard from Cape Cod and would say, you know, I'd address it to Yankee Stadium. "Dear Winfield, went to the beach today, got a hole-in-one in mini golf, be home in 4 days." And just like Willie, no last name, just Willie. And I'm sure they all ended up in a pile in a garbage can or
That's
something.
That's right.
That's right. But that was my, I got hooked on the Yankees early on.
Yeah.
And as far as
going to games, we used to go to Cubs games. And that's where you learned they used to say of the Cubs, you're only as good as your fans. And the Cubs proved that year in and year out. But Willie would go and learn all the intricacies of the game. I mean, like buying hot dogs and pretzels and usually about $30 worth of stuff, and then he'd fall asleep, which is what you do at Gubbs games after the seventh. Maybe they should play six innings like Little League. But from there, we went to New York and found a whole different world.
I have to say, I was raised, my parents met at the University of Illinois, so I was raised an Illinois fan in New Jersey, which was
my second senior year.
Yeah, they met his second senior year. That's what he always says, if I hadn't failed every class, I never would have met your mother. But I went to college at Vanderbilt, and you all at Penn State have stolen our wonderful coach, and I hope you're happy with yourselves. He is awesome, by the way. You're going to love him. We miss him terribly. So then I went to Vanderbilt and became an SEC football fan. And those are, you know, we follow the Yankees and most of the New York teams. And those are some of our best times, are going to Yankee games.
Yeah, and I also coached our son and daughter in Little League for 8 years. And that was fun. We got very close that way, too. That your kid gets more playing time when you coach. And we go through. Jody had to go through the draft. The draft, Little League fans, as you know, parents are the problem. And they would hold drafts. And I remember one of my friendly coaches said he always picked a kid with the best looking mothers.
Not a winning strategy. No.
No. Well, it depends on what you mean by winning.
He also said, my dad said, you have to also draft a kid with a pool for the postseason party.
Right. They didn't play. They were
on the
squad.
That's why we stunk so bad.
But those were good times.
Another great part of the book is you're introducing your relatives. And I especially liked, Willie, your uncle, what was the name?
Herb.
Uncle Herb. Yeah.
Yes.
And
his name's spelled H-E-R-B. You figure it out.
And the trip to Atlantic City to see the Stones was a classic story.
Yeah, it's a long one. You'll have to read the book. It's my mother's brother, Herb, who we love so much. But he is a combination of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards put together. And he's a Stones fanatic. And when he goes to a Stones show, he goes to a Stones show. He wears the leather pants and a tight black T-shirt and a scarf and boots with chains on them. This is a man who like started his own company and his children.
When I used to go to the games with him, I always felt like his manager.
Yeah. So my dad used to go to Stones concerts and my mom too with him all the time. And at some point, the torch was passed to me. And my dad and my uncle Herb picked me up one day at work in New Jersey, and we flew down the parkway to go see the Stones in Atlantic City. And I won't get into all the details, but he had a fully stocked bar for me in the back seat of his car with ice and the whole thing. And then at some point, he was an expert in pharmaceuticals, shall we say. He told me to look in the side panel of the door, and the music was on, and the windows were down, and there were two Ziploc sandwich bags. One said Willie 1, the other said Willie 2, and they were just teeming with pills of some kind. And most of them, it turned out, were like Nature's Plus vitamins and Aleve and strange things like that. But he'd done this so many times that he'd coordinated when you take this bag. And then you take the second bag and exit whatever it was as we neared the Atlantic City Expressway. So by the time we roll into AC, we're just ready to rock. And we pull in, we slam on the brakes, and right up on the marquee it says, Rolling Stones tonight, canceled. Now what do we do? We've got sandwich bags in us, and we don't know what to do.
At that point, you didn't know what canceled meant.
Right. So we ended up, I enjoy going to Atlantic City sometimes, but there are certain casinos which are extraordinarily depressing. And I think we ended up spending the evening in one of those playing blackjack while he was in his full Keith Richards garb, and no one knew why. Because apparently it had been announced like the day before, and somehow we missed it. But we did go back to see them when it was rescheduled, and I had to do the whole thing over again. That's Uncle Herb.
Okay. We know there are a lot of you here. We'd like to take some questions from the audience for Bill and Willie. I believe we have mics in the audience, or a mic in the audience. Anybody have any questions? Yes, sir, right up front here.
Thank you so much for coming to the Free Library. We've enjoyed your presentations on both networks. I'd be interested in having you each tell us a little bit of how you got to CBS Sunday Morning and NBC Today.
I can divide up rather quickly. I was a photographer in Vietnam in the Army, and I was hanging out with writers and photographers, and I decided this is what I want to do. They told me I should go into advertising, but I didn't. I thought Coke is it should not be your greatest accomplishment. So I found out I could get out of the Army early by going to grad school. So I went to University of Missouri's grad school, which is a great journalism school. Got a Columbia fan out there. And then from there I went to, my father had told me not to get in. He owned a country newspaper. And he told me not to get into journalism under any circumstances because journalism to him was lying under a broken press with a wrench all day and trying to get the damn thing to work. But so the first thing I did was took a job at the suburban section of the Chicago Tribune, where I labored for 8 years. There are people convicted of manslaughter that don't get 8 years. I was in a basement out by the airport. And from there, I had a stroke of luck. I mailed all my clips out to 3 or 4 cities and saying, my wife and I are moving to, and then you fill in the blank. And I was lucky enough to get a call back from, I thought it was the end. I didn't know what I was going to do, write insurance pamphlets or something. I don't know. I was about to give up. And the New York Times hired me, and I did the About New York column there. And I was there for 7 years, and they called one Saturday morning. Don Hewitt, the guy who created 60 Minutes, he was a big fan of the column. He said, have you ever thought about TV? And I had just read an article that Andy Rooney received $1 million advance for what he does and did. And I said, yes, I have. Especially lately. So I went to the CBS, and I've been on Sunday Morning and lots of other shows and been to the Olympics and all that kind of stuff, had some great experiences. Charles Kuralt called me to convince me to go to Sunday Morning, and he called from a payphone. It's so typical. He called from a payphone down in Texas somewhere. And he said, come on and do it, it'll be fun. And that I'm a sucker for fun. So if he'd talked about the dental plan, I probably wouldn't have gone for it. But I think Willie, too, is a sucker for fun in a lot of ways, and I think that's maybe one thing that he got by osmosis from me.
I'll give you the short version of mine. I graduated Vanderbilt. I was driving the liquor delivery truck in our hometown in New Jersey at Wine and Spirit World in Hohokus, New Jersey. It was supposed to be a summer job. It bled into the fall. Then it kind of edged into the holidays. And I was starting to hear some whispers from my mother in particular that maybe I should go get a job.
The responsible parent.
But I will, this is true, I will say my dad said, you know what? Don't rush into anything. We're getting the family discount at the liquor store.
How many agree with me?
I said, pump the brakes, son. Don't jump into anything here. Okay? This is a very important decision. But I did leave there eventually, and what I wanted to do was to work for Conan O'Brien. I was a huge fan. So while I was working at the liquor store, I put together a writing packet. And I thought it was brilliant. And I put it, I can tell you the mailbox I put it in outside the liquor store, right on the corner. And I waited and I waited for my big break. And it took weeks and weeks and weeks. And finally, I got a letter back from 30 Rockefeller Plaza, where Conan made his show. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is it. This is the moment. Drink it in. Here it comes. And I opened it, and it was the worst form letter I've ever received in my life. It said, "We not only will we not use any of your material, we have not read any of your material. Because for legal reasons, I guess I could say if there was a similar joke that I had sent it to them. So they had to be clear that they hadn't even glanced at it. They just threw it right into the garbage when they saw what it was. So that was a little bit demoralizing, but I had a bunch of friends living in Atlanta because I went to school in Nashville. So I decided I'm just going to move to Atlanta. There was the Atlanta Journal-Constitution there and CNN. So I applied for a job at both, entry level. AJC was not hiring. CNN had just started a 24-hour sports network called CNN Sports Illustrated. And it was me and a bunch of young guys like me covering sports and having a blast. And I learned, I was at CNN as a producer for 6.5 years, and I did everything you could do in TV. I was an editor, I logged games, I was a line producer, I was a segment producer and a field producer. And at some point I got sick of that, and I wanted to come back to the New York area. I took a job at Fox Sportsnet on a show that was canceled after 9 months.
Not his fault.
And that was exactly 10 years ago right now. I was completely out of a job, had nowhere to go. And just by a stroke of luck, MSNBC hired me and three of the other guys from this Fox show as freelancers to work on one of their shows that they were developing. And eventually they hired us full time. So in the space of a couple of months, I jumped from sports to news. And then these little wrinkles in time, but when Don Imus weighed in on Rutgers women's basketball, he was occupying the 3 hours from 6 to 9 a.m. on MSNBC, and he got fired. And so the next day, that's a big chunk of time in TV. They had to fill 3 hours. And when I tell you they were throwing people from the hallways onto television, do you have an NBC ID? Good, you're on. Go ahead. You're carbon-based, aren't you? Get up there. So that was just a big tryout period. That was 7 years ago, and then Joe Scarborough decided there was something he was really going to pursue. He came from his primetime show, and then I didn't really know Joe, just a little bit. Didn't know Mika at all. My dad knew her better than I did from CBS. And at the end, the last three standing were the three of us, and that was 7 years ago. And then over the course of that time, I started doing pieces for the Today Show and filling in for Matt occasionally, and then less than 2 years ago, I joined officially.
So when somebody asks Willie, young people will ask him how he got where he got. Well, there's no straight line for sure.
Yeah, but I think everybody's like that. You've probably all had that in your career. Somebody helps you out, you get some break that you could never have seen coming. And
you worry about your kids that they're not going to get that break. The one that I got that sent me in the New York Times, it was an editor. I just sent it to the managing editor of the New York Times, didn't even know his name. And he passed it along to the personnel guy who was out on the beach drinking and reading applications. And his wife said he started laughing down there, and in sobriety said that they wanted more humor in the New York Times. They got it for a little while.
Okay, any other questions? Yes, this gentleman here on the aisle.
Well, yeah, I start my day with Scarborough and see you on there, and eventually migrate at 9 o'clock down to the Today program.
All right, that's what we like. Yeah. You're a model viewer.
I truly do. While she works.
Not that it's a sore spot, ma'am.
Right. I was wondering if you could review your day. How early does it start? And could you do me a favor and on your way down the elevator change ties at least?
Ouch.
I get up. People always ask, the first questions I'm asked, when do you go to bed and when do you wake up? So I'll just tell you. I usually go to bed about 10, and I wake up at 4. The alarm goes off at 4. I've gotten better at snoozing. And I've sort of timed out how I can push that a little bit. Morning Joe starts at 6 o'clock. So I get in there an hour before or so and get a little touch of makeup. And my hair hasn't moved since 1987, so I don't have to do anything to that.
We got him some TV hair when he reached a certain age.
Yes, it's a nice piece.
It's the one thing we've done for him.
And so then I do Morning Joe from 6, it depends on the day, but 6 to about 7:30, sometimes later. And then I go down to my office for 45 minutes or so and sort of recheck in on the Today Show, see what's coming up. And I literally go downstairs in the elevator, run across 49th Street, dodging cabs, and I run in the side door of Studio 1A because the Today Show is right across the street from the main 30 Rock building. And I do that until 10 o'clock, and spend the rest of the day out on shoots and interviewing people and kind of looking ahead to the next day. He wants another tie.
What time did you wake up when you drove the truck to deliver the...
What time did I wake up? When I drove the liquor truck?
Yeah.
Probably noon. Yeah. I was 22, you know what I mean? Yeah.
That's when people start drinking, most people.
Yeah.
Yes, lady in the middle there, please.
Here you go.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Libby is fantastic. She's got a, she hadn't slept because she has a 7 or 8 week old baby. And she works for ESPN Films, the 30 for 30 series. She won an Emmy recently, and she's won 2 Peabody Awards, for which you have to do something that has social significance, so Willie and I don't have those.
I really resent that. That cooking segment I did with Martha Stewart the other day, social significance.
Well, you should submit it. And she also has a wonderful young boy who's coming, just almost, he's about a month away from being 2 years old. So she got a 2-year-old and an 8-week-old, and she's running her ragged. And Jody, we live nearby. I think Willie mentioned that. Our whole family lives within a 15-block radius. So it's kind of like a small town. But I like small towns.
We had dinner at our apartment a couple nights ago, and the door flew open. There was my mom with a baby Bjorn on, with the little 8-week-old baby. It's like we're all pitching in, trying to make this happen.
We're raising their dog. Yeah. Which actually are smarter sometimes than the kids. to this point.
Me or her?
No, her.
Oh, her.
There's a gentleman in the third row with a cat.
A long time ago, my father died from complications of Parkinson's, and he did not have your courage. He could not come out to his place of business.
It might have been a lot worse, too. You know, I mean, there are so many degrees.
Well, I mean, whatever. I mean, he could not do what you're doing. It was a family secret. It was hidden. It was very brave of you to do this. And I just applaud your courage and admire you so much for
thank you
taking a public stance and letting people know about this. Mm.
Thank you. I say that I came out same week Anderson Cooper did. He'd seen the publicity that I got. You do whatever you have to do to make it in this TV world. No, but seriously, I kept it from my kids and stuff. Honestly, I do believe because I didn't want to burden them with it. And also, I thought from professional reasons, I'd never be considered for another, and I haven't been. I was sort of waiting for Andy Rooney to retire, maybe around 75 or 80. He died at 92 in that job, after I'd had Parkinson's for 20 years. It was sort of a standoff.
I will say, as you know, it's not an easy thing to live with or to tell people about, but for my dad to work with it for 22 years and show up for work every day, and to work in a job where millions of people see you and watch you and wonder how you're doing, and I think that's why it was important for him to finally tell people about it, because it was like this release valve was turned on, and everybody could say what they'd known already. And he got floods of emails, and I got all these emails. We've known, Bill, we didn't want to say anything. We love you, we love you. And even our family friends, you know, like my parents' friends who didn't officially know, although they knew, now they could come out and talk about it. And for me, that moment 2 years ago and going on this book tour, the absolute best part of it is for me to hear from people like you and people who say the great things that my dad deserves to hear. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you.
So this is sort of a two-part question. I'm wondering how you got to be Willie, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
Where are you, junior?
I'm not technically a junior. I never have been. I have a different middle name. Does that mean I'm not a junior, I guess?
It does, indeed.
I was Willie from the moment I was born.
I thought it was kind of presumptuous to name your son after yourself. So I was lobbying for something, Marty or something, I don't know. But Jody and his mother and her mother thought that Willie had red hair. And I used to have flaming red hair, a bozo look, kind of. So he became William, and Russell was my dad's name. And he'd passed away shortly thereafter.
Yeah, so I was William Russell Geist, and then I was Willie. And when I went away to college, I thought, I'm a man now. I'm going to be Will. Now I'm Will. And if you go into the archives at Vanderbilt, there's about a month period where I have papers that say Will Geist. And I tried it for a month, and I just said, what am I doing? This is not who I am. So I went right back to Willie. So I've been Willie my whole life.
Now we have
for
a Billy.
Month. Yeah, now my
Billy's
sister's son is
the
Billy.
The 8 week old is Billy. So Billy, Willie, Bill, Billy Bob. He's actually Billy Bob.
Billy Bob.
He's it's William Robert.
My sister loves that, as you can imagine. Hey, Billy Bob.
He chews tobacco in his crib.
Big lipper.
Wait. I have a second part.
Oh, part two.
Part
yes.
two.
Sorry.
Yeah. I was just wondering when you realized your father was wise. I mean,
when he was what?
When he was wise.
Oh, when he was wise.
I mean, did...
He hasn't
he?
Come to
yeah,
that.
Is that
I don't think.
No, I would not say that at all.
I think
no.
We could have a debate if you'd like to come up here. I say I am.
I don't know. I don't know if wise is the word I've thought. What I will say is we talk about not having these conversations. That's kind of the point of this book. But sometimes you don't have to have them if you kind of live a good life and lead by example. And I watched how hard my dad worked, but then came home and somehow made it on the short line bus from Port Authority from the New York Times just in time for our baseball game and our practices.
For Jody to have to cover for me.
Yeah, but he was there, and I have, I don't, this is not a weepy father-son book about unfinished business and dad, why didn't we have the relationship? We had a great relationship, and he was, I have visions of him always being there at the moments that dad should be there.
You want to tell
me? We just didn't sit and talk about it.
We have a quick story about that, just spending time together. In Nantucket one summer, we went surf casting. And I woke Willie up at 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning. And I hate to get up too, so does he actually. And we went out surf casting and probably cast about, what would you say, 1,000 times?
Yeah.
Nothing. And I see Willie down the beach in the fog, and I say, Willie, no, he says, Dad. I said, yes, son. And he said, this really sucks. And I said, yes, son, yes, it does.
As if to say, of course this sucks, but... This is what fathers and sons do. You get up early, you're miserable, and you go fishing together. I said, well, you could have at least taught me how to fish rather than just stand here in the surf.
This all made great material for my column.
Yeah. I sensed I was just a character in some of his media.
There's a couple people up the aisle there.
Hi, this question is for Willie. I'm an early riser, and so I love Way Too Early as well, and I just wanted to say the show's not been the same since you gave up the helm there.
Oh, thanks.
And I'm also interested in shows like Way Too Early that I'll call irreverent news programs, and where you guys draw the line. Way Too Early recently got in trouble for crossing the line on a Cinco de Mayo joke.
Right.
But, if Howard Stern did it, clearly it would not be a problem at all. So if you're news, but you're also irreverent, how do you guys discuss what crosses the line?
I always think... It's okay to be a news person who has a sense of humor, but when you cross the line and you try to become a comedian, then you've lost your way. It's NBC News. Your job is to disseminate information. You can do it in an entertaining way, as a lot of people on our network do. I think Rachel Maddow is really funny. The way she presents the news, she has a sense of humor. She's incredibly smart, but she's also very funny. So I think you just have to be smart about it. And that's what I mean, it helped that we were on at 5:30 in the morning. It almost felt like a late night show, you know. It felt like no one was watching, so what the hell. And on the West Coast, it was on at 2:30, so it was a late night show.
You often addressed those viewers.
Yes, yes. They were rarely sober, but that was okay with us. So yeah, I think the danger comes in when a news person starts doing like stage comedy bits and things like that. My view was the news is central, and then if you can kind of do around the edges, give it a little personality and a little sense of humor, and obviously you see some of that on Morning Joe, then it just makes it more digestible for people, more interesting to watch. But yeah, I didn't do a lot of character bits with sombreros and things like that.
Didn't you do one with a sombrero?
No.
This is for both of you. Are there any celebrities or people in the news who you would like to interview who you haven't? And conversely, are there people that you have interviewed who you hope you never have to talk to again?
Careful.
Boy, you're not getting that one out of me. I've never interviewed the president, and I mean, it goes without saying that any journalist would like to spend some time with him, but those are few and far between. Even our senior White House people have trouble getting their hands on him. So it's kind of an obvious one, but if you could get an hour with the president of the United States, that'd definitely be mine.
Yeah, I go with that too.
Copycat. I was going to say Khloe Kardashian.
But is that on the want to or not want to?
Yeah. What makes Khloe tick tonight?
Over on the side, up against the wall there.
This is more for Bill than Willie. I'm from Evanston, Illinois myself.
All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where
and not only that, but my parents met at the University of Illinois also when they were students there.
Oh, cool.
Where in Evanston did you live?
We lived in an apartment on Southeast, would you say? And Northwest.
What the? Longdale.
The house. Our first house was in Northwest Evanston.
What street?
Lawndale.
We had the Lawndale Lawnmowers Precision Mowing
Team.
That's only
a few blocks away from down Central Street from where I lived. I lived on Eastwood.
Really?
Come on! On Eastwood? Wow.
Let's get you together for a drink after this. It's fantastic.
The Evanston reunion. In the back.
Again, I want to thank Bill for being public about your Parkinson's. I've had symptoms for 7 years, and I try to be out about it, but I'm not as famous. But thank you very much for saying those things.
I appreciate you saying that. Thank you.
And I do want to ask if you have a regular exercise program. Maybe you've already put it in your book. I don't know.
No, I do not.
That answers that question.
All right. I'm glad you brought this up.
But I do. But now that you've indicated that you are also a grandparent, I'm an expecting grandparent, and maybe you have some words of wisdom to pass on.
It'll make you feel a whole lot better about the Parkinson's when you get a grandchild. They're the greatest things going. Do I have any? Well, one thing, you've spoiled the hell out of them. Give them candy and everything that Willie and his wife try to keep away from the kids. And watch your decorating. Our coffee table has rubber tips on the end and sides of it so that it won't gash their heads. And we've gone from kind of a New York semi-sophisticated living room to a Fisher Price look. Strong reds and primary colors.
It is. There's a plastic fire station and a barn, and there's all this crap in their beautiful living room. Sorry about that, Mom.
Right back where you are, the lady there.
Hi, I'm a big Morning Joe fan, and I want to harken back to irreverence in journalism, and I want to ask what your best story is of Mike Barnicle. It completely escaped me. I'm sorry.
Best? Oh, my gosh.
A story about Mike Barnicle.
Wow. Well, for one thing, Mike Barnicle, he gets all his clothes for free from Modell's sporting goods store. We had an event at the 92nd Street Y last week in New York, just like this, a nice big crowd up on a stage, and he was nice enough to do as Joe's doing and walk us through the conversation. And he's sitting like this, and he's got a pair of loafers on, and he's got white ankle socks on with his loafers. His shirts are always Under Armour, those kind of meshy, and he just wears them because they're free.
And he's the last person that should be wearing athletic wear.
But the thing about Barnacle is he's kind of the real-life most interesting man in the world, because although he appears to be very nonchalant and sort of man of the people, we'll be sitting on the set talking about whatever the issue of the day is, and he'll get a text on his phone. I go, I go, what? He's like, Carrie. Who? Carrie? Who's Carrie? Is that your daughter? John Kerry. Secretary of State John Kerry correcting something we just said on the show in real time. He's the most, I don't know quite know how he does it, because if you ask him, he would like to be on his couch watching the Red Sox. Like,
and I think he is most of the time.
Or at Fenway watching the Red Sox. And I try to trace back, like, how do you know John Kerry so well? And it's from years of being a journalist, and people are just gravitate to him. They love him. He parks in the players' parking lot at Fenway. He doesn't carry tickets. He just waves to the guard. And he's like a movie character. You know, he knows, he's like, that's Tommy. He walked the beat with my brother in the 60s. You know, like, he knows every cop. And the thing I'll say about Barnacle is he takes time with everyone. And there's a reason people like him so much. I mean, if you stopped him on the street, he'd sit and talk to you for 10 minutes. And I think he's a lot like my dad in that he's much, much happier hanging out with the cops and the firefighters than he is with, although John Kerry texts him, he doesn't want to be up on the Cape with, you know, the Kennedys hanging out. He's just a real guy, and he's been a surprise in my life. You know, I've gotten to know him so well over the last 7 years, and he's a great friend, and he's exactly what you see on TV. He's a great man.
We have time for one more.
Willie, this one's for you. I'm just curious, because there's such a disparity politically on the show in the morning. Are there any real arguments between folks on the left and folks on the right? And might you cite some anecdote?
Well, the show, that's not show business. When they're arguing for real. I mean,
but they don't really get down and fight. Joe is... part theater and part real.
There's some theater. I don't know if, I think it was yesterday's show. That wasn't so theatery.
No.
They were like veins popping out of the neck. What's that? Yeah, I think he was screaming at Chuck Todd, too. But no, I think what we set out to do when we started the show, and this comes from Joe, and yeah, you know, he's a fiery guy, he has his moments, but we didn't want to be the classic cable news setup of, here's a conservative, here's a liberal, here's the red meat in the middle of the table, now fight. We wanted to have a conversation like you all have, even when you disagree. You don't scream at each other and call each other names. And so the concept of the show, or maybe you do. Say you do. You'd be better in prime time, maybe. Okay. But we just wanted to get, and it took a while to get there, we wanted to be a place that attracted the best and smartest people on whatever the subjects were, and to have them sit around like it was your breakfast table. I used to call it fantasy breakfast, because it was like, if there was a topic and you could have the most interesting person on that topic, they'd be sitting at the table. And so hopefully if you're at home watching at your own breakfast table, you're listening and saying, oh, I'm so glad that I was able to hear that point of view. And we try to get divergent points of view, and Joe is obviously the strongest voice on the show, and he's obviously conservative, but if you look at the scope of the 3 hours on our guest list, it definitely skews more toward the left, and hopefully we don't always achieve the balance that we set out for, but I think we do a better job, hopefully, than most shows do. Hopefully it's not totally predictable every day, which can't be said for a lot of media today.
Again, the name of the book is Good Talk, Dad, and we'd like to thank Bill and Willie for their hour. I know you appreciate it.
Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.